Hi, I'm Rick Outson, publisher and owner of In Weekly, Pensacola, Florida's alt-weekly newspaper, and the author of the Walker Holmes books, City of Grudges and Blood in the Water. And this is And the Murders Began. These podcasts are conversations with best-selling authors about their craft. This episode features Rich Zaradnik. Rich is the Seamus Award-winning author of the popular Coleridge Taylor mystery series. Rich was a journalist for 30-plus years, working as a reporter and editor in all major news media, including online, newspaper, broadcast, magazine, and wire services. He held editorial positions at CNN, Bloomberg News, Fox Business Network, and The Hollywood Reporter. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Rich, you spent 30-plus years as a reporter and editor in all sorts of media. What were some of the important stories that you covered?
Oh, well, as the list would indicate, I had a lot of different jobs, which in journalism was permitted. I think it still is what's left of journalism, but you didn't pay a penalty for jumping around. So I worked in different media and covered different sorts of stories. Most memorable probably started in college. I was at GW when Ronald Reagan was shot, and so my college paper got access to the briefing, ad hoc briefing room when they were briefing on him when he was being operated on. So at 19, I sometimes joke I peaked. I covered that. But going into my career, I mean, early in my career when I was 25, I owned with two partners a weekly newspaper. We were the newspaper for the city of Peekskill in Westchester County, which at the time was, you know, suffering a crack problem, had a crime problem. You know, we were dealing with, this was in 1986-87, an African-American young man who was shot by a police officer, and that's a long time ago, but luckily it was only in the leg, but there were conflicting stories about what happened, and that one stands out because it got a State Press Association award. If I jump further forward, at the Hollywood Reporter, I got to cover the Cannes Film Festival, which is a whole different thing. I'm going from, you know, crime to glitz. That was very interesting to see it because it is a festival, but it really is a market. It's where film rights are bought and sold. So just covering those and the Berlin Film Festival, as the London Bureau Chief for the Reporter, I learned a whole lot. You learn a whole lot about countries by studying their media.
Mm-hmm.
I really learned a lot doing that. And then, you know, I guess coming forward, I was the launch executive producer for CNNFN.com, CNN's financial news website, and that was in 96, so that's Web 1.0. So I was running website in the very early days of news websites, and I would say there wasn't any individual story, but the whole idea of figuring out how to build a news website and what the rules were and how you would do things. And I always say when I get asked, what my favorite interview in the end was one that didn't become a story. I went to what's called the Critics Tour, where the TV networks roll out their programming for the season. And I was at the HBO event. At that time, they had a Ray Bradbury anthology series. And at that time, it was pre-home video. HBO was the big money in Hollywood. And all the big guys, the Times, the Wall Street Journal, they wanted to be up next to the president of HBO because he was a real power hitter in Hollywood, calling shots. So I was from a third-tier trade publication no one had ever heard of, and the woman comes over and says, oh, I have somewhere for you. And she sat me down at a back table right next to Ray Bradbury.
Oh, gosh.
And I had been, I'm still a huge fan of his. I had been a fan of his since, high school. So I spent an hour being an awful fanboy, and then we spent the next 4 hours talking about writing. This was years before I'd start myself. And it's the best interview I ever did without ever getting a story out of it because there was no business line in it. I couldn't do anything for my publication, but it was just a great time.
Wow. So you have a weekly newspaper background in this mix of experience, that's my background. I've spent 20 years as an alt-weekly in Pensacola, Florida, which is...
Yeah, I start my first job before I got out of college was at the, you know, there's a difference between alts and communities, but they share the idea of, you know, providing coverage to their community. I was a reporter one summer for my own hometown local weekly before I was even out of college. Then with my partners, I started the Peekskill Herald, and now I've come full circle. I'm writing fiction now, and I started teaching kids here in Pelham, New York, where I live, And our local paper went under, and a bunch of kids I had taught said they wanted to start a paper for the town. And by that, they meant a real paper, not a school newspaper.
Right.
So I'm now the mentor to the Pelham Examiner, which we believe is the first first newspaper owned by student shareholders and run by student-aged people. And it covers the entire town. So, yes, I'm very much a local weekly guy at the beginning and at the end. And in the middle, I would just buy them wherever I went because I was still, you know, obsessed with them.
Right. Well, it you know, for us, it's – I grew up in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta, which my accent sort of gives me away. But where the newspapers were a big part of the civil rights movement. And
Sure.
With Hiding Carter, who I dedicated my first book to, his Delta Democrat Times, you know, took on Jim Crow laws, took on segregation. So when I got into it, I had that attitude in my head that we had to be that kind of publication, which for us was it took a while for. We had enough scandals to cover that after a while they realized that we actually were reporting the truth. But it took a while for that to happen.
That's always the problem. I mean, even before we had, and I don't know, you know, where this will get me in trouble, but even before we had a president who denigrated the newspaper business or newspapers and journalists on a regular basis, I mean, I was 20, 30 years ago, you know, I had town councilmen and school board members who didn't trust me just because I was carrying that notebook, you know, and you spend all your time trying to write a fair, balanced story, and you know, earning trust takes a very long time.
Right. Well, yeah, we're that rag, and we're a free publication, so of course
Sure. The
politicians were, you know, it has to be free because nobody would pay for it. So that's what we dealt with.
I've heard that one.
As far as how did your journalism help you transition over to a mystery writer?
Okay, so this is at least specifically with me, a good story. I sat down to write my first novel in the early 90s when I was living in London with The Hollywood Reporter. And I thought, since I had now spent 20 years or so writing all these sentences, that, you know, this would be, not a no-brainer, but, you know, I would easily adapt to it. And I completed a manuscript that will never see the light of day. It did get an agent and a bunch of rejections, and I would never, you know, I'm never pulling it out again, because what I realized was that, the things I knew about sentences and things like that were important, but as novels, you know, you require a voice. For example, you know, the great ones have a voice. That's what agents and editors are always looking for, and readers sense when they read it or hear it in their head. And of course, newspapers, you know, whatever the newspaper you're writing, unless you're a columnist, is the voice of news writing, the voice
right.
of your particular paper. The Times has a voice, the Journal has a voice. So I had to learn voice, and I had to learn big things like story structure and stuff like that. So, you know, part of it, I was kind of halfway there. Part of it also was in that first manuscript, I tried to be too accurate about how everything worked and how the journalism I was writing about worked, and that made it boring. There are points, and I know we'll talk about it, you know, my four books are about a journalist, where I depart knowingly from what a journalist would do or what would happen, excuse me, because, for example, journalists don't, in the real world, solve crimes. It's the
right.
cops that, you know, chase people down and arrest them. But in mystery novels, you need your protagonist to do that. So it was changes like that.
Yeah, you know, for me, and Rich, I had the exact same issues in that I had a real, and it may be because I went to a Mississippi college where coloring was a degree, but,
sure.
the tense was a big problem for me because I was, you know, if you're a journalist, you're writing present tense or near past, it was yesterday or it's next
yep.
week, and tense just, I wrote the entire book the first time I wrote it, you know, it was in present tense, and it was just awkward, and the editor said, you gotta fix this before we go any further, and my stories do have a basis of truth. There are events that have happened, and you have that obligation in your head that I need to get this factually right. and then you realize you could open yourself up to libel, so you have to figure out a way to change it somewhat. But
getting away from that as a fiction writer is if you've got a journalist mind, and I do, particularly when I'm now working with the Pelham Examiner, which is the paper the kids own, it's a different thing. You're making up stuff, and at some point you really need to make up stuff that wouldn't happen in the real world, or it wouldn't look like that, or it wouldn't be exactly like that. So I hear what you're saying. Knowing the mechanics of journalism, made it easy. I mean, when I wrote the books that were published, I went back and used a journalist, but I had learned a lot, and therefore, there's a lot that I left out. I learned to describe things less or just give a little taste rather than describe every piece and part of the printing press. You'll notice a lot of journalists write novels, write mysteries. I think you've interviewed Dick Belsky, who's a friend of mine.
Oh, yes.
But at the same time, there are a lot of people who aren't journalists. So I think what it indicates is, yes, we're good at deadlines. We've written a lot of sentences. But that sort of, however you want to architect the book, I use a three-act structure, and however you want to create an imaginary world, not describe a real world, those are things that you have to learn to do, even if you're a journalist.
Right. I mean, we grew up in a world of deadlines and word count, and that helps somewhat, but it makes it difficult. The dialogue, I think, was the easiest part for me because I could hear the voices when I write, and I think that's
right,
because
that comes from doing a lot of interviews and quoting people. I always find dialogue to be the easiest also.
And at times it gets magical where the dialogue, if you really get into your characters, you listen to them speak.
They start talking, basically, I mean, I don't need to, I'll get hung up sometimes, but then when they really start talking, that's, usually, sometimes they go back and say, what were you thinking? But usually, that's when the scene starts to work.
2014, you introduced us to the reporter Coleridge Taylor in Last Words. How would you describe him?
Okay, so the book is set in 1975. People need to know that. Well, I'm going to describe an idea. I started from the idea, and if you write about ideas, I think you end up with boring books. It gets pushed further and further down so that you more sense it than are getting it in your face. Journalism was over the period from the 50s to the 70s professionalizing. Before the 50s, most people who went to work at newspapers went straight out of high school, if they finished high school at all. And they'd be, they'd be a copy boy, and then they worked their way up. By the mid-70s, it was changing. There still was that one route, but people were going to journalism school because of Woodward and Bernstein. In fact, there was a flood of people going to journalism school. And Taylor is a kid who grew up in Queens. I didn't want a Manhattan New Yorker. His dad teaches at the City University of New York, not really a high-paying job. So I consider him kind of working class, even though his dad was, you might say, more professional. And he graduated high school and got a job, I forget what the exact number, I think it's 8 or 9 years earlier with the paper. So he's got a chip on his shoulder about all these college-educated people that are flooding into the newsroom, and that chip shows itself in different ways. He is, beyond that, he is obsessed with the story. He is obsessed with finding out what happened and why. He's a crime reporter. In the first book, he's a crime reporter who's been demoted to obituaries. That's why it's called Last Words, to find a way off of Obit's desk, but he is definitely the reporter I never was. I was not as brave as him, even if you forget the part where he's actually chasing the criminals, but in terms of his reporting and his single-mindedness, I mean, I was always changing jobs because I wanted to try different and new things. I think in Taylor, I created the kind of reporter that I in some ways wished I was, who's just, got a monofocus on the story that he's working on.
Well, one thing that jumped out at me was how well I can see the newsroom. The newsroom is a real room. I mean, for those who are in journalism, we can all identify with it. And I think for those who aren't, are getting an accurate portrayal of the politics of a newsroom, of a story, of who gets inches, who gets to do the coverage. All that was just really came across strong.
Thank you. I mean, you try and do that well, you know, and then again, it's always that balance, you know. If it's too much, you know, it becomes a textbook for the people who really don't care about journalism. So you try and give, you know, I always think of the, you know, what's the one or two or three words that's going to, like, make the scene come alive for people versus writing five paragraphs on describing the city editor or his desk or something like
right.
that.
Yeah, what we do, what I did in mine, and my character is a newspaper publisher in Pensacola. I wanted to use Pensacola. And the news staff is young. And the staff meetings are called the war room because everyone's fighting for space. The reporters want their stories in front. The A&E thinks they should be the star. The editor's trying to keep everybody in line and make deadline. And the salespeople want to be sure what they sold the advertisers is what they're going to see in the paper. And in an all weekly, you have all that in the same room. That's your salespersons in my books are also the receptionists or the copy editor. We all, you know, so it's a family, but it's a dysfunctional family.
Yes. Sounds like a lot of newsrooms.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think it works. What is Coleridge Taylor's fatal flaw?
I would say it is, funnily enough, since I've already mentioned it, that monofocus. He chases after the one story and often decides what the one story is rather than what his city editor or his editor wants. That happens in more than one book. It's a little maybe cliche, but I try and make it interesting in terms of why there's a tension. He does have those blinders on, just trying to get after that story. He's a decent guy. He's not mean to people. He doesn't run people over or anything like that, but he doesn't sort of see outside. I mean, you know, he can be surprised by things because he is just chasing that story so hard.
Now, when you write, do you use outlines or do you fly by the seat of your pants?
I am a pantser. I fly by the seat of my pants. What I do, my process is I write and I use something called Scrivener, which is,
right,
for lack of a better way to describe it, it's an app that allows you to do index cards. And then I tend to then write chapter summaries after I've written the chapter on the index cards. That way I can keep track of what I've done, and it makes it easier to do a synopsis at the end, which is, they're very painful to write.
So, right.
That is a minor point, I guess. I mean, I will occasionally, I'll think of something, I mean, I'm like three chapters ahead, so I'll think, oh, like in three chapters I want to deal with the beard. So I'll type just the beard on the index card for that. But like, if I'm in the middle of the first act, I won't have anything on the cards, you know, for the first half of the second act or the back end of the story. I might have something about the ending. I have sometimes when I've, you know, gotten jammed or not been comfortable with something. I did this with a manuscript I have on submission now. I sat down with a legal pad and mapped out some things that I really thought I needed to do in rewrite. So I mean I view outlining as, you know, the 40-page single space. You write the entire story and then you sit down and write the story from the outline, which if I tried to do, I would get to the third bullet point and want to just start writing.
Want
to expand that scene because it's all in my head and I'll lose it. I can't do that. I think probably every pantser does a little bit of lining here and there, at least I'll admit to it. But generally, you know, I'm sitting down at a blank page with a couple ideas that I left for the last day and trying to carry it forward.
You think that's part of being a journalist is why? Because I have a hard time with the outline part two, because
yeah,
I kind of...
Let me think. The outliner, the journalists that I know that write fiction, I don't think I know anyone that's an outliner.
Right.
And, of course, as you know, when you sit down on deadline, there's no time for an outline. I mean, I've worked for dailies. I work for, you know, Bloomberg, which is a wire service, which is, you know, every second's a deadline. You don't write a deadline. You just... You know what the lead is, and if you get the lead right, the rest of the story will, you know, usually take care of itself. I think it could be a journalism thing. There are non-journalists who don't outline. There are a lot of people that do outline. And, you know, every conference I go to, there's a panel where people debate it. And, you know, I think it's kind of like, you know, do you like cheese or rye bread, as I say. It's like if you like the one, that's what you are. I mean, I personally, the way I always explain it is, if I sat there to do the outline, I've heard Patterson described as, you know, he writes a 40 or 50 page outline, I would get to bullet three and start writing because I'd see the scene, I'd hear some dialogue, and I wouldn't want to let it go.
Right.
And so that's why it just doesn't work for me.
Yeah, a lot of times I have a pretty good idea for the beginning, and I have usually a very vague idea of how I want it to end, and I know how I want my characters to grow and evolve, but you just start going and just see what works.
No, definitely. I have sometimes known the ending, and I have sometimes not. I heard one, was it Laura Lippman who said, some great writer, so I'm at least attributing it, said this, like when she writes a book, she knows the beginning and she knows the ending, but the rest of it is like driving a car in the fog with your high beams on. She knows where she needs to get, but you just see what's in front of you. Sometimes I'm clear on, you know, what the ending's going to be. I think three of the four mysteries that are published, I didn't know who the killer was when I started.
Wow. The last words, you have one of the best first sentences that I've read in a long time. The dead sitting on his desk could wait.
Thank you.
The importance of that first sentence. How important do you see that?
Oh, man. None of the three books after this, that's the best first line I've written. And it comes with a story, as does everything. The opening scene that you're reading there was pretty much what it was for months, and I went into a workshop called the Crime Fiction Academy and workshopped the first chapter. And people were liking it, but there was something about it that just wasn't clicking. And then the CFA is based in New York. It's part of the Center for Fiction. I was in the first class of it. And then we had a master class with Lee Childs, who writes the Jack Reacher books. And he gave a talk that he's a Brit, quite ironic, quite facetious, but he gives a talk, Tell, Don't Show. Now, as you know, the edict to everyone is show, don't tell.
Right.
And he gives a talk about reasons and why and how telling rather than showing works, right? Or it can be worked or whatever. And I'm sitting there thinking, and what I realized was, well, what I needed to open the book was one line of tell before I showed, because as you know, you've read it then shows him looking at a newsstand with a headline that he couldn't write because he's stuck on obituaries, and we get into the story. And it all came from that Lee Childs. I got to thank him someday. I mean, I the line didn't pop into my head immediately, but I just kept experimenting with lines that would tell his predicament in enough of a way that would make you want to keep reading. And make me sound like an egomaniac. I really do love that first line.
Oh.
And I think the other three books open okay, but that's the strongest first line I've written.
And it, again, you're right. It fits the story. It fits being in the, you know, having to do obits, but you just take that sentence alone and you've got to keep reading. There's just, you can't stop.
Question. I mean, even if you haven't read the back cover, it asks a question: how could Dead be sitting on his desk? And that's how I get into, you know, in the first page or two, you learn his predicament. He was demoted, and he's trying to find a crime story that'll get him promoted or back into his old job as police reporter. But yeah, thank you, because I like it too.
It's good. Your latest book for Coleridge Taylor is Lights Out Summer. It won the 2018 Seamus Award for Best Paperback Private Eye Novel. How did it, Taylor, evolve from Last Word to this book? Because that's always a fascinating thing that I like to see in a series, is see the character evolve.
We know in a series you can evolve them some, but you can't kill them.
Right.
You know, some people have that, you know, Karen Slaughter killed off one of hers, but then again, she was going to get a contract for three more books on another series, so it didn't matter. But there's, you know, the amount of evolving you can do, but they can't be static either. So with Taylor, his predicament evolves in a couple ways. he starts dating a woman in the newspaper in Last Words, the MT, the Morning Telegraph, which people nicknamed the Empty. I had fun with that, but and she's a Columbia grad, and there's tension there, and then she gets hired away by the Times, and that falls apart, and so he ends up dating a cop who he helped out in book two, which is Drop Dead Punk, and that relationship stays through the end of I'm not spoiling anything, but they have their ups and downs. They're more kind of from, you might say, similar backgrounds. She's from the Bronx, he's from Queens. The other thing that happened, and this came up, I know you know this, you do big things that just come out of the blue, or at least I do as a pantser, and right in the middle of Drop Dead Punk, I felt somebody had to die. And then I decided, no, somebody didn't have to die. The newspaper he worked for had to die.
Oh.
And it goes back to, early on I wanted to write about the early 60s in New York when there were, like, still seven newspapers. But the period wasn't as interesting. So I set it in the mid-70s and added a fourth newspaper to the mix of the Times, the Post, and the Daily News to give that feel of multiple papers out there. But right in the middle, again, because of his blinders, he saw some of the signals, the paper goes under. So by Lights Out Summer, he's working for a very small wire service that a colleague of his has started to serve radio stations and newspapers. If for some reason they get something the AP doesn't, and so he's not kind of at the big paper anymore. His kind of job position has changed. I think those are kind of the big changes that go on around thing. I mean, his father, he's lost his father during the period. I suppose I give out. No one will read the books, but I think he learns something from that. I think he becomes a bit more rounded and real as we go on because I became better at doing that. That wasn't intentional. That was kind of technique coming to me as I did the stories. He's still the guy that wants. The story. He's still the guy that wants the story that no one else cares about. That's his other big thing. And I'd say that would kind of encompass it.
When you read, who do you like to read?
I love Michael Connelly. Michael Connelly has been my go-to since two decades at least. But one for, as a practical example, he was a journalist who became a crime writer. I was a journalist who became a crime writer. But though it must be clear, I had far less experience as a police reporter than he did. I had 0.05% of the police reporting experience. I mean, I did it in different places, but I also did all those other things. From a technique standpoint, I like Michael Connelly because I think if you read him, there are some writers who, their style jumps out at you, like Mosley, Ellis. But I like Michael Connelly because you read him and you really don't think you're reading someone who's throwing style at you, right? And then suddenly he's got you. I mean, it's this sort of sneaky way of the way he uses language and structure without being flowery or anything like that. But your pulse races and you turn the pages.
Right.
I'm not copying his style, but coming out of journalism, that's kind of a way or a type of kind of writing that I would aspire to also.
Well, and he's created so many successful series, and of course it's been on Prime with the Bosch series, but
sure.
The Lincoln Lawyers is just as fun, and he's created a world that you're right. You want to get the next book because you want to see what's happened, how everybody's changed, or what's going on in their lives.
Yeah, I read a lot of crime. He's kind of, if I have to name my number one go-to, it's him.
Great. Well, Rich, thank you for spending time with me today. This has been a great interview. I'm glad to get to know you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you having me on. Good luck with your writing as well as your journalism. I feel we're a bit kindred there, although the Pelham Examiner is nowhere near as big an operation as your newspaper, but good luck with all of it.
Great, thanks.
Thank you for listening to And the Murders Began. To learn more about Rich Zaradnik and his writing, visit richzaradnik.com. To find out about Walker Holmes and his Pensacola, check out rickoutson.com. Again, thank you for listening.